I'll give you a little sampling. He often refers to himself in the poems. Forget every idea about right and wrong. Forget every idea that any classroom ever taught you. Because an empty heart, a tormented mind, unkindness, jealousy, and fear are always the testimony that you have been completely fooled. Morning. Turn your back on those who would imprison your wondrous spirit with deceit and with lies. Come, join the honest company of the kings and the beggars, those gamblers, scoundrels, and divine clowns, and those astonishing, fair courtesans who need divine love every night. Come, join the courageous who have no voice but to bet their entire world that indeed, indeed, God is real. I will lead you into the circle of the beloved's cunning thieves, those playful royal rogues, the ones you can trust for true guidance, who can aid you in this blessed calamity of life. Hafiz, look at the perfect one. Look at the perfect one at the circle's center. He spins and whirls like a golden compass, beyond all that is rational, to show this dear world that everything, everything in existence does point to God. We have all come to the right place. We all sit in God's classroom. Now, the only thing left for us to do, my dear, is to stop throwing spitballs for a while. I'll give you one more short one, and then I'll read you the real one. Not that the short ones aren't real. I rarely let the word no escape from my lips, because it is so plain to my soul that God has shouted yes, yes, yes to every luminous movement in existence. Hafiz also had this belief. He used to tell people, sometimes you need to get a little rough with God. You can't always be the fragile supplicant. Throw away all your begging bowls at God's door, for I have heard the beloved prefers sweet, threatening shouts, something on the order of, hey, beloved, my heart is a raging volcano of love for you. You better start kissing me, or else. Maybe later I'll read you the one I always read to get half the room to walk out. But this is really the story of the soul. So we said we would talk about the soul's journey. Here it is. Once God made love to a saint who had a great hairy belly. Of course, things like that can happen. And it was a surprise only to the novice on the path, when the saint's stomach began to swell just like a woman's. Weeks went by, and then months. The saint's cheeks turned into beautiful roses. He became like a young bride who was carrying a holy child. And his gratitude was speechless. But his eyes shone like two planets making love. The town began to stand outside his house at night, for it had come to the attention of the faithful that as the moon passed by on its round, it would sometimes bend over and kiss his roof. Of course, things like that can happen. Life went on amidst the other 10,000 wonders, whiskers and weeds and trees and charming babies kept emerging. People and cattle and bees worked side by side, all sweetly humming. And come lunch, all dined on the same mysterious, divine manna of nourishing love. Disguised in 1,000 shapes and colors and forms. Galaxies gave away their ingenious ideas and told us of their private bodily functions. So man, too, eats, burps, and excretes more worlds. How is it that invisible thoughts can lift heavy matter and build cities and armies and altars? All contain a hidden strategy to be transformed again and again into divine music and love and light. The sun rolls through the sky meadows every day, and a billion cells run to the top of a leaf to scream and applaud and smash things in their joy. Of course, things like that can happen. Rivers stay up all night and chant. Luminous fish jump out of the water, spitting emeralds at all talk of heaven being anywhere else but right here. Clouds pull each other's pants down and point and laugh. Oh, my dear, of course things like that can happen. For all is written within the mind to help and instruct the dervish in dance and in romance and in prayer. The stars get clearly drunk and crazy at night and throw themselves across the sky. Only an insane being or compound is not going mad with excitement at this wonderful performance by God. And still, light stretches out its arms, open even more, and shouts to you, because you are his lover, to forget your harsh actions of the past and just dance. Look, angels and flowers are playing hooky in graveyards, laughing and rolling naked on the cool stones. Why go to sleep tonight exhausted from the folly of ignorance, when even the beloved is drunk and is doing wonderful, ecstatic somersaults and is giving wild lessons between the sheets and between his handstands all up and down the tavern floor and ceiling? Indeed, indeed, things like that can happen. A few days before the delivery of God's baby, the saint had to visit a city close by where few knew of him. He was walking unnoticed past a mosque, and the shouts of God's lovers happened to fill the air, calling, "Allah, Allah, where are you? Where are you, O beautiful one? Where are you, Allah?" And the child, in the womb of the master, could not remain silent and shouted back in an astounding voice, "I am here! I am here, dear world!" The crowd in the mosque became frantic, and they picked up shoes and clubs and stones. You know what then happened. The story becomes quite grim. But the moon cannot hold a grudge. It still stops by some nights and leans over this gentle earth as over a crib and gives a full wet kiss. For the moon knows that God is always amorous. God will never stop making love. For the truth has been divinely conceived deeply within each one of us. O Hafiz, look at the splendor of God's grace. The sun has been planted in 1,000 furrows across every soul's brow. Of course, my dear, everything God and I say can happen. Hafiz. So some of you were not here yesterday, and I'll give you a little brief background of a brief talk that should take 2 weeks at least. That took 2 hours that I'll now do in 2 minutes. All is one. All is love. Out of the oneness comes activity. Out of the activity comes an accommodation, a place. And that place is filled by the consciousness that emerges from the activity. The first realm is the angelic. Each realm that the soul passes through, it needs a garment of that realm in order to experience that realm. So the soul, which is infinite, timeless, and placeless, in the angelic world, this world of almost infinite time and space, still needs a body. The angelic body, it's not like a body that we know. It doesn't have form in the real sense. It's a vibration. But it needs something to experience that world. So it draws to it by its essential magnetism, the fineness of the luminous atoms of the angelic world. And those atoms collect around a point, and that point becomes that angel. There is no relatable way to communicate the being of an angel and the being of a human, except that within the human is the angelic being, because we've not only pass through that world, we exist in that world simultaneously as we exist in this one. From the angelic world, there is a transformation of some few souls, remembering that all souls are the same. All souls are just an activity of God. No old souls, no young souls. But we'll get to that in a minute, why we think there are. The jinn world, the next world, is the world of form. This is the world of great musicians and poets, these incredible statesmen, not politicians, but statesmen who have brought their genius to the furtherance of the human condition. These are the worlds where form is created and designed, so to speak, even though there's not a group of designers with AutoCAD coming up with new flowers, but the orchestration of beauty is occurring there, and we see the production of that orchestration. There are many, many, many levels of this world, and naturally, when the soul is in this world, it takes on another layer of clothing, so to speak, another garb, another body, and that enables it to experience its journey through this world. It's really very simple, this thing about bodies. If we awoke tomorrow in the Arctic regions, we probably would not last too long with our clothing of California. We wouldn't be prepared for the terrain. We wouldn't be prepared for the environment. Well, in each place that the soul visits, it needs to find what the local people wear and pull that together. And it is important to remember, as I said yesterday, that when one is done with that, when the consciousness is done with that plane, or even the subconscious, it needs to give back to that place the clothing that it's borrowed to stay alive. And then finally, the soul, after passing through these many planes of existence, of consciousness, comes into the earth plane. The earth plane is the furthest plane from the source, and yet in many ways it's the closest. Why? What does this mean, this thing about the human being made in the image of God? Well, all is God. As we are children, when we're children, we can't accept really that all is God, so we change it. And we don't say the zikr like we did last night, la ilaha illallah, which means all, there's nothing exists but God. But we say some is God. We say what is good is God. What we like is God. What we idealize is God. But as we mature, we begin to recognize that there is nothing but God. That which we perceive as bad is also God. It's all related. It's all part of one being. It is not possible to say this is and this isn't. It's possible to say this action is good and this action is bad. It's possible to say this feeling, this moment gives me a feeling of bliss and this moment gives me a feeling of confusion. All of that is true. Nevertheless, all is God. And some people find difficulty with that because it's not very neat. And we like things to fit in an orderly way. And of course, for Sufis, they are more concerned with balance than with neatness. And it would be quite an unbalanced world if some was God and some wasn't. What if you weren't? You know, what if I was and you weren't? That wouldn't be very nice. So better that we all are. But in order to have movement, there is duality, always duality. Once we go beyond the place or state of oneness, there is duality. In duality, there is always this combination of power and love. And there always is one half that's more powerful, one half more able to receive. That's what makes the wheel turn. So you have two hands, one hand is more powerful. You have two nostrils, one nostril is more powerful, one eye is more powerful, and so on. Yet the one that receives, in a sense, has a greater function. But if the one that receives did not live in a world of power, it could not exist either. So there's a symbol that the Sufi use that's very interesting. It's a symbol of the plow. I don't know, I forget the name of it, but there's a plow that has a big wheel, it's a hand plow, big wheel and a very small wheel. And the small wheel can be angled so that you can guide the big wheel with the small wheel. So here's the big wheel that pulls the plow and does all the work. And here's this little wheel about one fifth of the size on the side that does all the guidance. So the little wheel is the receptive wheel. It doesn't have the power, but it has the wisdom. And the big wheel has the power. So all is God, good is God, bad is God. And all is relative in this relative world. Many people for the wrong reason try and make the absolute relative, and the absolute when made relative is not absolute anymore. Now the absolute is not better than the relative, and the relative is not better than the absolute. The difficulty arises when we're in the relative and try and make ourselves believe we're in the absolute. And the opposite is true also. When we're in the absolute and try and apply the laws of the relative. So the journey continues. Some few souls make this journey all the way to the human made in the image of God, which means the image of all. And they're furthest away from the very essence, the very source. Now, I said yesterday, but if you aren't here, I'll repeat it again. Nothing that I'm saying is true. It's just a story. It's an allegory. So that something in our minds, in our hearts, will be kindled and will develop a certain level of understanding which will push us to go deeper. And as we go deeper, then revelation occurs. It's akin to the aha experience in psychology, except it's on a cosmic level. Instead of understanding, oh, I get it about me, it is, I get it, period. And it's interesting moments. It can be very subtle. It doesn't have to knock your socks off. It can be done with a feather as well as with a stick. And probably it's easier to recover from if it's done with a feather. And often awakening occurs through our enemies, and we're put to sleep through our friends. So it's an art, it's not a science. It's not techniques that you learn. It's an art that you acquire. So we've been through the angelic world, and we've been through the jinn world, and the jinn world has so many planes, from very pure light planes to planes where there's great absence of light and limitation and darkness. You don't stop everywhere. Some souls spend eternity in the angelic plane and then find themselves on the human plane and barely have any memory of the jinn plane. Many of these people find life very difficult, life on earth. You'd think it would be easy for the angelic soul, but it really is not. Life here doesn't make sense. They're very gullible. They're very innocent. They're easily led. Their consciousness is really elsewhere. You look at them and you say they don't belong here. But it's all part of this perfect plan. Remember, God is not some being in a, you know, with a big white beard sitting in a cloud pulling strings, and where are the little puppets dancing on the string. It is this absolute absoluteness, this presence and this absence. It is the duality and the oneness behind the duality, and there is no atom of creation that it is not. It is not about other than it. It is it. And now I'll share with you a great esoteric secret which will make it worthwhile to walk through the rain all the way here this morning. There's all this talk about awakening. Now, this is the Sufi terminology. I can put it in a Buddhist terminology, and sometimes I do, but this is a very Sufi morning, so we'll stay with the Sufi terminology. Many people are seeking awakening, and they have the erroneous idea that it is they who must awaken. And that concept prevents awakening, because you then proceed to work for your awakening. And as soon as you say your awakening, it is impossible to awaken. It is about the awakening of the consciousness of the divine in each one of us. So it is God awakening. And what we can do is we can prepare the temple. We're not the prayer, and we're not the prayer. We're just the sweeper. And we can prepare the temple. The temple can be this body, which it is, and we do certain practices that prepare the temple. The temple can be the mind, which it is, and through concentration, contemplation, and meditation, we prepare the mind. And as we make the preparations, that which is eternal, that which is unnameable within us, remembers itself and awakens to itself. I don't mean this in any negative way, but would it really be fulfilling enough if you awoken? I mean, is that what we came here for? To have you awaken? The idea is to have the all awaken in the limited. That's why I said we seek for unity but not uniformity. Because the awakening of God is unique in each person. That's why the path, the true spiritual path, which isn't any path that's named, but the true spiritual path is an opportunity. It's just constantly creating a unique opportunity in each one of us for the elements of God's awakening in each one of us. What's so special about these human beings? I mean, it seems like the angels are much more elegant, you know? They're filled with light. The whole angelic realm, it's all light. There are just these vibrations, perfect vibrations of light, beyond time and space, as we know it, certainly. What is it about the humans? Well, I'll tell you a story, because it really has to do with the journey of the soul. A sweet story. There was an angel. Now remember, none of it's true, so I can make up anything I want. There was an angel who woke up one morning, if angels slept, which they don't, and was kind of grumpy. He had heard about these human beings and got the rumors of what they do in their lives, the death they cause, the destruction, the irreverence, the all of it. And he just went to God and said, look, I don't quite understand this. You seem to have this special relationship with these beings. They sound miserable. They sound terrible beings. I mean, I just don't understand. This is kind of a cleaned up version of the story of Lucifer. What could you possibly see in them that could make you feel this way for them? And God said, you know, my friend, I think you'll have to visit for yourself and see what it's like and come back and report to me. You know, what really is God? God is the being of tolerance, of open-mindedness, unlike its creation. We're not always so open-minded and tolerant, but... So, in the next instant, this angel leaves this world of light and wakes up in this thing, this form. And He just lies there, completely shocked. And then gradually realizes that the thing moves. And somehow he's connected with it. And he stays there for a while and stays there. He just has no idea what to do. And then he gets this feeling, this strange feeling. He's never had it before. It's quite common to us. We call it hunger. But he didn't know this feeling. And he thought, well, I wonder what one does about this. Do I keep this or do I let it go? And at that moment, an apple falls out of the tree. He's sitting under an apple tree or lying under an apple tree. He takes the apple and he eats the apple. And he goes, oh, this is wonderful. This is magnificent. What an experience. And he sits there eating apples, thinking this is life on earth, and going, well, this is really not so bad at all. The next day, this beautiful young woman walks by. All of a sudden, he has a different feeling, very different from being hungry for apples. And he stops the woman and he said, you know, I'm new here, and I don't know what this feeling is, but I'm experiencing something. And I won't go into the details, but they fall in love. And they have a wedding. And he said, well, why do we need a wedding? And she said, well, of course we need a wedding. We need to bring God into this. We need to bring the oneness. Otherwise, we'll just get lost. And he said, well, of course the oneness is in this, but let's get on with it, you know. But she said, no, no, go slowly. We'll have the wedding. And they have the wedding. And the next year there's a child, and they have the blessing of the child, and every day she does prayers and practice. And he said, you know, I love God, but there's no reason for all of this stuff. We all know that God is real. Let's just live our lives. We don't need any of this. And she always slows him down and says, no, you don't have to do it, but this is what I need. Well, more children come and the business grows and they have a big apple business, and he's quite happy and she's quite happy, and she gets deeper and deeper and is so thankful for what they've been given, and he's just caught up in the business and his children, and he loves it all, and they have a house, and he's just so excited to be alive. And then I kind of want to say, like the Hafiz story, then you know what happens next. The pendulum swings the other way, and they lose the business, and he loses his children and his wife, and he's alone, and then his soul cries out. The deep emotion of the soul, not the limited emotion of the movies, but the deep, real emotion. And in the next instant, he finds himself back in the presence of God. And God says, so what did you learn? And he said, I want to worship at their feet. God says, why? He said, I want to worship at their feet, at the feet of human beings. And God says, why? And he said, with all of the difficulty and the struggle and the pain in that world, they remember you. So that's our journey. You know, that's zikr, remembrance. That we have this opportunity to remember. It doesn't matter if we do or don't. Just to know that we can. What a gift. What a gift. Do the souls know nothing of life on earth? They do learn. How do they learn? They learn from the souls coming back. Every soul makes the journey in reverse. And every soul gives back to each world what it took for it from it. And every soul must rid itself of everything it owns of that world before it can leave. Regardless of how many statues and so on you bring to your tomb, you don't take anything from this world, like it or not. You do not take anything from this world. You give back everything of this world. And even though the nafs, the ego, might really want to take it with it, sorry, you don't. But unfortunately, you do take a lot that you keep in the mind. Any vibration, any impression that is unfinished, that has not been brought to rest, travels with you. So you enter into this new world, bringing these concepts from this old world. Some of you know I have a travel business. Now it's not quite a real business. I do one or two tours a year, and I only go to very strange places. I don't go to any place that's not strange. This summer we went to the source of the Ganges up above Gangotri in the Himalayas, which is quite a serious trek. And we went there not to go to the source of the Ganges, but we went there because I have a friend, a very old Swami, who's there, and I was afraid he wouldn't be around too much longer, and I thought people might enjoy meeting him. As an added benefit, we went to the source of the Ganges, which was quite a powerful experience, really quite a spiritual experience. But anyway, it's trips like that, and I left my commercial message on the table. My next trip is to Jerusalem in February. Now, I have to tell you that I've been to the Holy Land 5 times in the last few years, the last 2 years. And there are people there, realized human beings of all faiths, who are consciously holding the post of peace. And their consciousness is very beautiful and quite filled with light, but I must say that they get exhausted. Even they get exhausted. It's very hard there. And so the last time I went a month ago, I wouldn't take anybody because it's just too difficult right now. But they need people to come and, as one said, just come and have dinner with us. Don't do anything. Don't have to say any prayers. Just show up. So I'm going with a group of people. If you want to go, it's not a pleasant trip. You know, it really is not a pleasant trip, but it's a meaningful trip. You'll meet people that are quite unusual. And a month ago I was there and I said, look, if all of this fighting is about Israel and Palestine, get rid of the names. Just call the place the Holy Land. And if you need to personalize, call it my Holy Land. And both sides can call it my Holy Land. And people were quite, it wasn't the most popular thing I ever said. But I then said something that was even less popular, and I said, look, if you're fighting over the wall and the rock, get rid of them too. And I said, you're attached to this 5,000 years, and look at what the symbology is, a wall and a rock. You know, it's going to be very difficult. But it's a holy place. I mean, it's really a holy place. The whole atmosphere is filled with holiness. Unfortunately, it's also filled with tremendous confusion. Anyway, what I started to say is when people travel and they go into a new place, they bring all of their old concepts. And they're so happy when they find out it's not at all like I thought it was going to be. It's completely different from what I thought it was going to be. I like to take people to India because India seems to instill the most conceptual fears in people. Oh, I'm going to get sick, and there's poor people, and all of which is true. You don't have to get sick, but of course there's poverty. But India is a place with a lot of heart, great spiritual heritage. If we're open to it, it's a wonderful place to visit. So we go to these worlds and we bring our concepts from here. We cannot go further in each plane until we then get rid of those concepts. Are we left alone? As I said yesterday, no. There are incoming souls who we can unload this stuff to. And there also are the bodhisattvic beings who really stay there and help. Now, you don't get rid of this thing as a complete package. It's not like you give off every impression to one soul coming in and they become you. However, there are practices that I know the Tibetans do them and the Sufis do them, where you actually can hang on to almost the whole of consciousness and transfer it to a human being. This is how the Rinpoches and the Dalai Lama and Karmapa can pick out their prayer beads and their spoons and all of this stuff from among 50, because the consciousness has been transferred, the impressions of here, the memories, have been transferred almost in the entirety. Now, it can't be done fully in the entirety, or else every one of them would look alike. And I must say, I've seen pictures Sufi Murshid, Sufi teachers in an order that were five generations. They looked almost identical. And I was, this last time, a month ago, I was visiting with a Druzi sheikh. I don't know if you know what the Druzi are. It's a religion in the Middle East. Very esoteric religion. You need to be initiated into it. There's about 400,000 Druzi. And it is a synthesis of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism and Hinduism. They know a great deal is based on reincarnation and so on, which is not prevalent in the so-called religions of the West, the religions of Bene Israel. And I looked at their previous teachers, and they all looked identical. I thought this guy, the picture on the wall was him. He said, oh, no, that's my teacher. I mean, it looked exactly like him. So obviously others know the practice too. But for most of us, there's no point in keeping the consciousness intact in that way, so we pass it on. But most souls coming in do take the majority of the impressions they carry from one departing being. So we do each have a unique character in that way, and then, or a unique nature. And then we come to Earth, and our parents, our environment, and so on, form our character. And there's a third factor that forms who we are. We have the impressions, we have our environment, our parents, and the third factor, anybody want to guess? Okay, I'll tell you, it's our ancestors. Our blood heritage also directs our incarnation and impresses it. And there is something that is transmitted via the blood. It is not something to be ignored. We can ignore the character of our parents. They can shape us, and then we can unshape that conditioning. But we cannot ignore the blood, because those impressions are deeper than our environment. Now, the way that works is you might have an ancestor who might leave here consciously or might develop a very clear conscience after leaving here. And recognizing her whole incarnation was about this one very pure point of realization. All of the other stuff is gone, and this is the distillate. This is the nectar that's left. And they want to pass that on to someone in their blood, because it is easier for them to pass it that way. You know, blood, in Hebrew and Arabic, the word is Adam. It means the earth. It means existence. And so they'll wait until not just a soul coming in that's the right soul, but a soul coming in that's the right soul that has encountered some of their being the one with the distillate, their family, their bloodline. They'll wait for that soul to come their way. They'll wait a generation, they'll wait five generations, they'll wait whatever is necessary. But they'll wait, because time is very different there. And they'll give that very unique impression onto that soul. So you might inherit something from your grandparents. Oftentimes, or great-grandparents, oftentimes it is the great-aunt or the great-uncle we inherit from. It can be the great-grandparents or the grandparents, but oftentimes it steps to the side if it's not coming through clearly. And it's interesting to watch inheritance. It's a fascinating thing. And so we have these three factors that make up who we are. Remember, the soul coming in knows nothing. It doesn't know good or bad. It doesn't know opposites. It doesn't know happiness and sadness. So it takes whatever is offered to it. How does it go? Why does it go to this soul or that soul? Because of laws that operate there that don't operate here. That's sounds like a cop-out, but that's the easiest thing I can do. I just can't explain it. If a soul leaving here is in confusion, the soul coming in meets that one. That soul throws off the impressions of confusion. This soul picks it up, and it comes in here, and its nature is somewhat confused. Or I should say it has an inclination towards confusion. None of this is written in stone. Now, even though we might not like the whole story, isn't it incredible to think of the freedom that is given in this universe? That all of this is going on, and there is one harmonious note, but that note is not imposed. It is constantly evolving in this world of relativity. So the confused person comes in with the absolute freedom to put that confusion, to transform it to clarity. I mean, it's incredible. Now you might look at it another way and say, oh, but that's so unfair, because this person has a confused impression and this person met Krishna on the way. That's so unfair. It is unfair from the point of view of duality. From the point of view of oneness, is it unfair that your toenails have nails and your head has hair, or some heads have hair? Is that unfair? No, it just is what it is. It's one body. What difference does it make? Well, if we recognize this, the oneness in this, not as an intellectual concept, but as an actual awakening, it makes sense. And there's a beauty to it, even to the tragedy. And nobody's exempt from tragedy. And when we begin to, as Llewellyn said, let live life. Life is for the living, it's not for the dead. When it's not a business transaction anymore, you know, we create this God in our minds. Oh God, I'll give you this, you give me this. That's no God at all. I mean, it's fine for children, but it's really not for an adult. Who is it, St. Paul, who said, when I was a child, I spoke as a child. Now I'm an adult, I speak as an adult. We don't want to be in this business relationship with the creation of our own minds anyway. This is why the Sufis have this lover-beloved relationship, because it takes it out of commerce. Nobody has to tell anybody how to fall in love. We're all pretty good at it. And it doesn't matter if you're 16 or 116, you still fall in love. If you get wiser, you're not attached to the object of your love. You give up the object, you get love itself. Oh, I have to read you something. It's about three lines, and we should probably take a break. I don't know how your bladders are and such, but... I guess I could do the index. No, sometimes we have to learn how to listen. It's very easy to listen. You just remove every thought of the future and every thought of the past and every wave of judgment. So you don't have to agree or disagree with this. It doesn't matter what we think about this. You don't have to apply this in the future or remember it. You don't have to see if your past fits into it. If you can do that, you can listen. Is love pleasure? Is love merriment? No. Love is longing constantly. Love is longing constantly. Love is persevering unweariedly. Love is hoping patiently. Love is willing surrender. Love is regarding constantly the pleasure and displeasure of the beloved, for love is resignation to the will of the possessor of one's heart. It is love that teaches us, thou, not I. I'll read it one more time. Is love pleasure? Is love merriment? No. Love is longing constantly. Love is persevering unweariedly. Love is hoping patiently. Love is willing surrender. Love is regarding constantly the pleasure and the displeasure of the beloved. For love is resignation to the will of the possessor of one's heart. It is love that teaches us, thou, not I. So that's this path, if you want to know it in a nutshell. So let's take a break.